Welcome to Book Review, brought to you by OWL Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Angie Larigoiti, and I'm so happy to be here. And during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the San Antonio Express News newspaper. I also like to read from the New York Times, some book reviews there on some best-selling books that are out for the week and what have you, and also from other sources. Now, in the New York Times books review, there are some new books that have come out. There are four memoirs and one near memoir, ranging from a family history of old money, Janie Scott's The Beneficiary, to an immigrant's account of abuse and displacement, Grace Tellison's The Body Papers, and from a queer coming-of-age memoir, T. Kira Madden's Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls, to a celebrated biographer's description of his methods, Robert A. Caro's Working. The near memoir, well, that belongs to the timeless beat writer Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who with Little Boy has published an autobiographical debut novel at the age of 100. You'll also find a couple of environmental books, one about our landscapes and man-made spaces, and the other about humanity's uncertain future, along with poetry, novels, new and old, and a story collection from one of Kenya's greatest living writers. And so first book, Baby, I Don't Care by Chelsea Minnis. The poems in Minnis' fifth collection play with notions taken from Hollywood's golden era and film noir, and she thanks Turner Classic Movies in her acknowledgments. It is one of the most unusual and persuasive books of poems I've read in some time, critic Dwight Garner writes. In her direct access, you know, to pain and sometimes wit, her knack for absurdity and disturbance, she can resemble poets as diverse as Anne Sexton and Patricia Lockwood. Then you have The Street and the Narrows by Anne Petrie. Anne Petrie's first novel, The Street, was a literary event in 1946, praised and translated around the world, the first book by a black woman to sell more than a million copies. The Library of America recently published The Street in one volume along with Petrie's 1953 masterpiece, The Narrows, and a sampling of her critical writing. Petrie wrote unabashed protest art in the mode of, you know, Steinbeck and Stephen Crane. Critic Parul Segrawal Siegel writes, her kind of talent will always feel startling and sui generis. The Body Papers, a memoir by Grace Tellison. In this precise, delicately constructed memoir in essays, Tellison writes about her experience as an immigrant to the United States, her survival of childhood abuse, and returning to visit the Philippines, her native country. Tellison has the instincts of a storyteller, teasing out her narrative through images and illusion. Critic Jennifer Zalai writes, the book doesn't track a one-way, you know, march to triumph from adversity. Tellison's essays loop in on themselves as she retrieves old memoirs and finds unexpected points of connection. Now, in Working, Researching, Interviewing, and Writing by Robert A. Caro, in a collection of pieces that is unusually short for Caro, he offers his observations on his career as a biographer and historian, describing his commitment to getting all the details of a story and relating the lengths he is willing to go in order to empathize with the people he is writing about. Our reviewer, Harold Evans, calls it an iridescent book and applauds the author's tenacity. His charm and his investigative genius, no other words for it, Caro says, has measurably enriched our lives with his intellectual, you know, rigor, his compassion, his openness, his wit and grace. In Nama by Sarah Blake, life on the ark after the Great Flood is filtered through the consciousness of Noah's wife, Nama. In the sensual and evocative first novel, a delirious contemporary riff on an Old Testament climate catastrophe. Reviewing it, Joan Silber calls the novel a wild and superbly intelligent, you know, reimagining that avoids the pitfalls of biblical retellings. Blake can evoke progenitous events in plain yet properly large terms, she writes, and there's an amused sanity under the gravitas. In The Beneficiary, Fortune, Misfortune, and the Story of My Father by Janie Scott. Scott is a former reporter for The Times, explores the consequences of generations of inherited mainline wealth as played out in her own family, especially through the lens of her alcoholic father, affectionately and mockingly called the Duke by his wife and children. It is often very funny with some moments paced like, you know, a drawing room comedy. Michael Gora writes in his review, yet the Duke inherited something more and other than money, and what just, you know, comes to dominate his daughter's narrative is her sense of wealth's misfortune. In Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out by Bill McKibben. McKibben is a veteran environmental writer. Never hectoring or hyperbolic here, he turns the possibility of human extinction from climate change, artificial intelligence, etc., into an absorbing analysis with a glimmer of hope tempered by cold realism. Some people hope that world problems will be solved by advanced new technologies. Jared Diamond writes in his review, considering each such technology in turn. McKibben explains his skepticism about its hoped-for benefits and his concerns about potential undesirable side effects. In The Absent Hand, Reimagining Our American Landscape by Susanna Lessard, it's a half-memoir, half-critique, this book by a former New Yorker writer seeks to understand how our malls, green expanses, and urban spaces reflect on our humanity. Lessard devotes much of the book to exploring what she terms America's utopia, our vast, seemingly unplanned inchote, exuberant sprawl, which remains to her largely inscrutable and tragic. Michael Kimmelman, the Times chief architecture critic, writes in his review. And she writes about such places from what you call an exalted literary remove, and the mode is epistolary, poetic, occasionally honest to a fault, and moral. In Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls, a memoir by T. Kira Madden, in telling his vast, arresting story of loving addicts, of a queer sexual awakening, of inhabiting a female biracial body in America, of assault, the author displays her gift for silent detail. It's a eulogy and a love song. Reviewer Tessa Fontaine writes, it's about girls and the women they become. And it's all compulsively readable, not just because of those big themes, but because of the embodied needle-fine moments that make the stories sing. In Little Boy by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, the iconic poet and activist who just celebrated his 100th birthday uses this autobiographical novel to recount his life story in a free association of flashes and arias of high and low culture. Ferlinghetti has the appealing old-fashioned enthusiasm of an autodidact. No one's biography has more completely or ardently embodied the visions and contradictions, the achievements and calamities, the social mobility and his of that lifespan. Robert Pinsky writes in his review that Ferlinghetti has not just survived for a century, but he epitomizes the American culture of that century. In Minutes of Glory and Other Stories by Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, the Kenyan writer's collection of short fiction tackles the absurdities, injustices, and fortitude of people testing new ways against the old. What shines through in Ngugi's stirring pages is a hopeful message. Delia Owens writes in her review, even after generations of foreign, then domestic repression, spiritual confusion, drought, and hunger, the resilient spirit, a gathering of real souls, lives on in Africa, no matter whose ghost or God is worshipped. All right, I hope you enjoyed. Those are some books that have selves. And these stories carry a certain air of having been written pre-2016 election, as if they rode the last wave of pop feminist optimism into the abyss. Taken now, these narratives have aged into cuteness. There is nothing cute, however, about the newest breed of misanthropic, gloriously self-destructive, essentially alienated young female protagonist, exemplified by two new releases, Hallie Butler's The New Me and Jen Began's Vacuum in the Dark, following the paradigm of established by writers like Otessa Moshfegh and Catherine Lacey. These latest heroines bespeak a literary era that swung past genial pessimism into repulsion. The tone of these novels is a rebellion cut through with apathy, with echoes of Melville's laconic Bartleby. They'd prefer not to, but not to sign up for yoga, go to brunch, meditate. These women refuse to make themselves better. And in the new me, Millie, the self-hating, rage-filled narrator whose rants would make Dostoevsky's Underground Man beam, surveys the scope of society's strivings and finds them not just lacking, but proof of life's meaninglessness. The tonal spectrum of this novel is narrow but deep, running from desperate optimism to despair and back again, all set in the glory mundanity of an office. She's a temp worker living a temporary life that has the quicksand feeling of purgatory. It's tempting to write Millie off, as her only friend Sarah does, as another privileged millennial, but she... The meaninglessness of it all washes over me again, she says, another intoxicating wave, the floor opening beneath me. I was playing this idiot's game of racking up things. I was doing that I didn't, you know, doing that I didn't want to do in service of some imaginary thing that I might one day stumble upon. Millie is a Sisyphus, you know, and her boulder is shredding documents. She's also in the process of trading her own last shreds of authenticity for the things that she's been promised all cure, you know, that will cure her of her rage and allow her finally to, you know, connect with others. I could have friends if I had more money. I could be easier to get along with if I had more stability. I could be who I wanted to be, calm, cool, self-assured, self-reliant, independent enough to attract people who could enjoy my company, because we're all independent people doing what we have to do to get by. Not like who I am now, she says, flailing, you know, filled with the puke, she says, thinking about death and feeling angry all the time. Millie's fantasy of getting a real job succeeds in making her entire life more real for a moment. But the gap between her hallucination of the perfect future and her lackluster present will close, and brutally. It's not that, Millie's delusional. Her dejection is depressingly realistic. And Butler provides breaks from Millie's point of view that reveal her distrust of others that is justified. Her co-workers don't like her. Her ex-boyfriend didn't like her. She offends nearly everyone. She smells. So does her apartment. Walking in the park, she is mistaken by onlookers as both drunk and mentally ill. And yet there's a nobility in Millie's inability to fake it. Now, in another worthy addition is Began's Vacuum in the Dark, a sequel to her much-lauded debut, Pretend I'm Dead. We're back with Mona, a cleaning lady who talks to Terry Gross in her head and has boundary issues with the charismatic clients who fascinate her. This novel is a joy, truly laugh-out-loud funny, while staying grounded and dignified, even as Mona capsizes, you know, again and again. She's a young woman haunted by the ghost of, you know, rape, abuse, incest, abandonment, and addiction, and set on finding people to help her bury her pain. She inevitably attracts more of it. And as the novel opens, Mona is cleaning poop, human feces, left like tributes around the house. Began thus metaphorizes Mona as a receptacle for the garbage left by irresponsible people around her. Her mother, who left her for pet parrots, a blind therapist who tells Mona that she smells of suicide, a Hungarian painter and opiate addict who persuades her to pose naked and dark, a married man who twists Mona's insides with a lust that leaves no prisoners. Mona takes it all, carries it, and cleans it. Yet as she rids herself of each leeching narcissist, only to fall under the spell of the next, the novel traces a burgeoning sense of self-awareness. Maybe she's an artist. Maybe she's stronger than people think. And remembering that she administered a morphine overdose to her perverted, cancer-ridden grandfather, she says she doesn't feel ashamed, you know, doesn't feel shame about it. Only relief. And she finally identifies it as a necessary revolt. The only shame I feel, she says, that I've been too passive. I haven't said no to enough in my life. If I had, I'd probably be a different person now. Less tormented, maybe, and more successful. So there you go. There's just two novels right there about these two lost millennial women. Those were just a few books there that I saw some that I wanted to talk about, some articles on some reviews in the New York Times. Now, a new story awaits, of course, and through Reader's Digest, here are some books that are some to check out. A woman possessed by Marilyn Herring, in the midst of great silk strike of 1913, Eleanor O'Banion marries a dependable, wealthy man. However, her heart belongs to a passionate union leader. And will she find personal redemption? We shall see. We have Mosquito Junction, Memoirs by Robert S. Saito. This memoir is about people Robert S. Saito met and the places he's been. They are ordinary, hardworking, devoted to duty military men, women, and people from all walks of life. In the Diary of an Iraqi National by Saad H. Al-Ahil, in the midst of 100 years of the life of modern Iraq from 1921 onwards, Saad H. Al-Ahil describes the different stages that Iraq has passed through. In A Woman Endures by Marilyn Herring, another one by Marilyn Herring, is about following the loss of her baby and marriage. Eleanor decides to move to South Carolina to run an inherited tea plantation. And there she will learn to grow tea and possibly something more. Romance. All right. In Cattails, The Real Pussy by Mick E. Jones. Cattails reveals that the spirit of a supreme being exists in all things living. And the book also supports the concept that cats are creatures of myth and mystery. In Hot Horse Harry by Jerry Lee Miller, Hot Horse Harry lived up to his name, mad at the world, but when a series of unfortunate events came, the hot-headed Harry changed. I wanted to read this article about an everyday miracle. This is His Heart Wouldn't Give Up by Theoden Janes from the Charlotte Observer. John Ogborn. Ogburn doesn't remember a single thing about Monday, June 26, 2017. He doesn't remember waking up that morning or helping prepare breakfast for his three young children or kissing his wife, Sarah Beth Ogburn, goodbye. He doesn't remember driving to a Panera Bread in Charlotte, North Carolina, or going to his favorite booth in the back where he regularly sat working on his laptop. And he doesn't remember crumpling to the floor at about 4:15 p.m., his heart having gone completely terrifyingly still. April Bradley was just starting her shift at Panera when her brother told her someone had passed out in the back of the restaurant. When they got to John, he was splayed on the carpet. His face was dark purple. It was the scariest thing I've ever seen, Bradley says. She dialed 911 and it was 4:17 p.m. As luck would have it, Charlotte Mecklenburg, police officer Lawrence Guiler was about 50 feet away. He had just tended to a minor accident and was about to get back on the road. Another lucky stroke before joining the police. He had been an EMT. Guiler arrived at Panera in less than a minute and began CPR within 30 seconds. Another police officer, Nicolina Bajic, rushed in. Coincidentally, I was already dispatched to a second accident in the same parking lot, Bajic says. And a few minutes later, four Charlotte firefighters arrived, opened John's airway, and fitted him with an oxygen mask. And they took turns performing CPR. They also used a defibrillator to try to shock his heart into restarting. It didn't. They shocked him again and again and again, and they gave him a shot of epinephrine to return his heart to a normal rhythm, then another, and nothing. No sign of life. More than 20 minutes had gone by. Nobody wanted to give up on him, says Bajic. And around 4:30 p.m., while John was receiving CPR from a total of 8 first responders, his iPhone started ringing. It was his wife. I called a couple of times, but he didn't answer, Sarah Beth says. I assumed he was in a meeting. A little over an hour later, she was heading to her parents for dinner with the couple's three children when Novant Health Presbyterian Medical Center called, and she was told John had gone into cardiac arrest. It was terrifying, she says. When I got there, I was taken into a room with two police officers, ER doctors, nurses, and clergy. Basically, they said, we don't know what's going to happen. Someone informed her that John had received CPR for 38 minutes before they established a pulse. The police estimate it at more than 45. In any event, it was a long time. Generally, after 30 minutes, you start thinking, when should we call this, says Amy McLaughlin, MD, the first physician to examine John. Now, he was transported to the intensive care unit and sedated in hopes of giving his body time to recover. 2 days later, on his 36th birthday, in fact, he started to wake up. He squeezed my hand, Sarah Beth says. I wasn't sure if I would ever have that again. Astonishingly, the only after effects were some short-term memory loss and extremely sore chest from the 3,500 compressions. Not many people made it out of that situation, Guiler says. Seeing that he made a full recovery, I can't explain it. Adds Dr. McLaughlin, everything that could go right for him did. Now that's a miracle. Absolutely a miracle. Now in other things I'd like to read on Reader's Digest, it's about an everyday hero, the water angel, in this article by Andy Simmons. Now, when Mother Nature's dangerous heat sneaks up on unaware hikers, it says here, this resourceful local comes to the rescue, this guy. Now, even if you've never been to Phoenix, you know this about the place, it's hot. Now, from June to September, the temperature can easily eclipse the century mark, but that doesn't stop hikers from attempting the 1.3-mile trek to the top of the city's famed Camelback Mountain. Signs warn that the trail is extremely difficult. If you continue, a posted checklist suggests at least a liter of water per person, and if you're still not deterred, another sign farther up declares if you're halfway through your water, turn around. Now, unfortunately, many people do not heed the warnings, you know, and fortunately, Scott Cullimore does when he's not running his carpet cleaning company in nearby Mesa. The 53-year-old Cullimore can be found hiking up and down Camelback a couple of times a day, doling out cold bottles of water to worn out hikers. Now, that's really nice, you know, really cool. And he has helped hydrate so many hikers that he has earned a heavenly nickname, the Water Angel. I'd like a more manly name, but you know, he told azfamily.com. Cullimore was on Camelback Mountain one day in 2015 when a British tourist died after being lost for nearly 6 hours in the July heat. And that experience inspired him to start helping people caught unaware by Arizona's unforgiving version of Mother Nature. They underestimate the mountain and they overestimate what they can do, and they can get themselves in trouble. If a hiker has a flushed face and is not sweating anymore, Cullimore says, he reaches into his insulated orange backpack, pulls out a frosty bottle, and hands it to the person. It's nothing for him to go through 8 waters, which he pays for himself, in one lap, you know, up and down the mountain. It's misleading that we're in the middle of the city. You can die up here and no one would know, he says. One hiker who availed himself of the pre-offered water agrees. You think you know the heat, but then you get out here in the desert and it surrounds you like a blanket, said Austin Hill, who was hiking after a high school friend. They were lucky, he said, pointing to Cullimore. We ran into this good Samaritan here, and with that, the water angel goes in search of another hiker in need. Now, I know we can all use, you know, a hiker angel, or I should say a water angel. I love hiking myself. So anyways, so definitely the water angel. It's nice to know that there's someone out there, and I'm sure there's lots of them out there, but this is one that was really great to read about, for sure. An everyday hero. There you go. This other, from the book Gratitude in Motion, this other, I should say, this is a coma miracle. This person had a 3-month bike accident, and this is by Colleen Kelly Alexander from the book Gratitude in Motion. This is a person who spent 3 months in a hospital after a horrifying bike accident, and almost dying is nothing close to what you'd imagine. And this is... this is something else. Okay, so it says here, the day I died was in the perfect New England fall morning. It was 11 a.m. on Saturday, October 8th, 2011, when I set out on the 12-mile bike ride home from work along the Connecticut shoreline. The sun was brilliant against the blue sky, and the leaves were starting to change colors. Sean was a mail carrier, was working, and says here... Sean and I were trying to have, it says it was an exciting time for her. She loved her job as a program manager at Peace Jam, an organization that educates kids about leaders in the peace movement. And at home, her husband of 1 year, Sean, and her were trying to have a baby. Sean, who's a mail carrier, was working, so she had plans with a friend for a long ride later that afternoon. So it says, as I settled into the right-hand lane of a busy avenue, a freight truck turned in my direction from a side street. He slowed at the corner. We made eye contact. Then for reasons I'll never know, he accelerated. There was nothing I could do but scream. The giant truck knocked me down onto my left side. My legs got tangled up with my bike. I heard snapping and grinding as front tires drove over me. I felt my insides cracking when his back tires did the same. People came from rushing from all directions as the truck rumbled away. Oh my God, I heard, she's alive. I raised my head just enough to see something bright white and yellow protruding from my leg bone, tendons, fatty cells. The skin had peeled off. Oh my gosh. Anyways, okay, it goes into detail, but says here, the ride to the hospital took about 20 minutes. The double doors of the ambulance opened in the sunlight, and from where it was straight to the emergency room, where for the next 8 hours, I kept dying. I would flatline, someone would do CPR, and they'd pull me back from the abyss. When they did this over and over, people had to keep rotating because keeping me alive was exhausting. With the odds stacked against this woman, the doctors decided to place her up in an induced coma, a life-saving step that slows down brain function and reduces swelling in order to prevent or lessen brain damage. Her fingers are moving, someone said in the room. During the period, she was in and out of surgery several times. You know, a medically induced coma can't take away all the pain. Nothing can. The coma just dulls it enough so that you don't actually die from the shock of it all. But over-medicating can kill you too, says doctor. So doctors must walk a fine line. But anyway, she thrived. You know, her injury, it made her realize how lucky that she was to have Sean. In the darkest moments of being locked in the coma, his voice soothed me, she says. It does to this day. With each step, I am gratitude in motion. So this, you know, I kind of skipped a few things, but her coma was a miracle, you know, that she got out of it, obviously. Amazing. Well, thank you for listening to today's books segment, book review book review. And if you have questions or comments about the program, please call us at 210-829-4223. And this program will be replayed after 9 o'clock this evening. And this is Angie Laragoiti saying goodbye from OWL Radio. Talk to you soon.